From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Film Week. Welcome, I'm Larry Mantle. This week, our Film Week critics review the new film's Trolls World Tour. It's an animated feature from Universal DreamWorks. The crime thriller The Quarry stars Shea Whigham and Michael Shannon. We have Iceland's Oscar submission from a year ago, A White, White Day, as well as the animated feature Away. Sela and the Spades, an Amazon Prime Video streaming movie from writer-director Tyresha Poe. Those and many more films coming up on Film Week. Plus, we'll tell you about Turner Classic Movies' special at-home film festival, which kicked off Thursday night. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us. Film Week, of course, adapting as so many of us are to dramatic changes in our lives. With no films in movie theaters, Film Week devoted to what you can see at home, whether they're brand new releases on video on demand, streaming sites, or cable channels, as well as the vintage movies and television series that our critics recommend. Joining us this week, Amy Nicholson, who's film writer for The Guardian and host of the podcast Unspooled and the podcast miniseries Zoom. Charles Solomon, film critic for Animation Scoop and Animation Magazine, and Leah Lowenstein, film columnist for the Santa Monica Daily Press. We begin with the animated feature Trolls World Tour. It was released last weekend, but not made available for our critics to see it. The film, directed by Walter Dorn, Jonathan Abel, and Glenn Berger, are the screenwriters. Charles, what'd you think?
Well, this film feels like you're sticking your head in a bucket full of glitter while somebody bangs on it with a pipe wrench. Everything is pitched way over the top, day-glow colors, more glitter than the entire Hobby Lobby chain uses in a year. Poppy is now queen of the trolls, but there is a threat to the realm that there were six magical strings that created six kinds of music that six different troll tribes live by, and now the nasty Queen Barb is trying to capture them all and make all trolls listen to this kind of gothic rock that she plays. Six kinds of music in the whole world. But the bigger problem is this is essentially the plot of Frozen 2, which I'm surprised more critics haven't noticed, that you've got the Motormouth Queen trying to do her best, trying to be a good queen, trying to solve a problem, only to discover that her family has caused it, while the tongue-tied hero can't figure out how to propose. Sound familiar? But it is a jukebox musical in animation with everything from the Spice Girls to a lot of other stuff that as a classical music fan I didn't recognize and was happy not to. And the musical numbers are strange because all these characters moving in sync, and now it's very easy to produce great masses of characters and surfaces with rendering, look less like musical numbers to me and more like somebody had spray-painted Kamazots in The Wrinkle in Time with day-glow colors. There's a lot of talk about, oh, well, differences are what make us strong, and all music doesn't have to be alike, and we all have to contribute to each other. But it is just wearying.
We're talking about Universal DreamWorks animated film Trolls World Tour. Lael, what do you think?
Well, first of all, I hope that Charles knows that I love him, because I also have to say, Charles, you are one of the biggest curmudgeons in the world to be a hater on this movie. I was a little bit skeptical going into it. I also had sort of forgotten how much I actually enjoyed the first Trolls, which was a colorful romp, memorable for Justin Timberlake's fantastic Can't Stop the Music, and a lot of other sort of delightfully silly elements. This is not as good as that first one, but in these current times, in this bizarre context that we're in, you know, I think we sort of need trolls more than ever. And And it was a lot of fun. Not only, by the way, are there six strings, but there are four separate musical bounty hunter genres, including reggae and smooth jazz and other ones. And they're sort of deployed at different times for different purposes. Yeah, I mean, it's preposterous and it's goofy, but there's a message about needing each other, which I very much related to.
We're talking about Trolls World Tour. Amy, you'll have to break the tie.
Oh my gosh, I'm right in between. And also, Charles is our curmudgeon. We love him. I mean, yes, this movie, it started and I was like, oh God, what am I in for? This is absolutely a headache. And it is wall-to-wall, bright, cheerful pop right at the start, you know, as the last one was. And then this is actually a movie that goes forth, and as our pop trolls explore the other kingdoms, they realize that not everybody else likes pop. And there's a scene where they go to the country music town and they start to sing Who Let the Dogs Out, and they get thrown in jail, which I have to say I appreciated. And I do like some of the kind of the supporting characters in here that Lael mentioned. I mean, the smooth jazz bounty hunters had me absolutely dying. I enjoyed little details like George Clinton is the king of funk in Funk Planet. Ozzy Osbourne voices the Rock King and is just sort of rolled out in this wheelchair being very confused and wondering almost like what. I'm not even sure he knows he's in a cartoon, honestly, the way that this plays out. I mean, there are in-jokes in here if you are like a music fan that I have no idea if kids will understand. You know, the pop starts to get shade at the end of this for being, as Lil kind of hinted, like the villain. You know, pop has historically tried to conquer all genres by taking their favorite bits of it and sampling them and then dominating them for their own, which actually becomes kind of a subplot in this movie, which should surprise me. I have no idea if a six-year-old, who the animation seems to be designed for in terms of style and brightness and color, will get any of the jokes. But I, as a person trapped in my house who also had to watch this movie, I appreciated them.
Yeah, so I think you broke the tie in favor of it, Amy, it sounds like to me.
Oh, no, I didn't mean to do that exactly.
Trolls World Tour is the film. It's rated PG, available on multiple video on-demand platforms. Next, the crime thriller The Quarry, directed by Scott Teams, who co-wrote it with Andrew Brotzman, Shay Whigham, and Michael Shannon star. Leo, what'd you think of The Quarry?
I thought The Quarry was a pretty good thriller. I mean, yeah, it's kind of souped up sort of quasi-noir, quasi-Coen Brothers, quasi, you know, a few different genres put together. But it kind of had me going. So it's about a drifter who is picked up by a Mexican man in somewhere in Texas, and they have an altercation, and the drifter kills the other guy and then decides to assume his identity. Turns out that the other guy is a preacher named David Martin or Martin. And so our drifter manages to have to pass as a preacher, despite the fact that he has no kind of religious leanings whatsoever. He learns about the Bible. And when he's preaching to this congregation in this very tiny town, he begins to have a connection with them. I loved Catalina Sandina Moreno. I loved she's got an important supporting part. Michael Shannon plays a police chief, and the lead actor Shay Whigham I thought was really quite good. He's a mostly theater actor, I think. You know, there's way too much kind of religious iconography and allusions that are a little bit too hit you kind of too much over the head. But I thought this is kind of a slow burn, and it was an entertaining and diverting thing to have for this week.
The Quarry is the thriller we're talking about. Amy, what'd you think about it?
Well, I'm always happy to see Michael Shannon show up, especially when he has one of the roles where he gets to do a couple of his tiny, weird, kooky giggles that always crack me up. Yeah, this film is definitely, it's a film that's really operating kind of on the level of like big ideas, big allegories played out in these really small, terse, tough little scenes. I had kind of tiny issues with it. You know, one of the major undercurrents in the film is there's like an undercurrent of racism where Michael Shannon, the cop, is really eager to pin crimes on these two Mexican-American brothers, crimes that, you know, aren't necessarily fair. And I have to say, as a Texan, like that dynamic felt a little bit off for rural West Texas. It didn't, and I went and did a little bit of research, and it's based on a novel that's actually written in South Africa. And it feels like the film kind of just took this idea that was in a book about South Africa and kind of plopped it in West Texas without really knowing Texas. So my Texas radar went off a little bit in bits of it.
Yeah.
I didn't love it. This is usually the kind of movie that I want to soak into. I like these kind of like small town noirs, and anything with Michael Shannon usually gets like 1,000 bonus points to me, but this film was more just okay. I could never quite love it that deeply.
The Quarry is the thriller. It's rated R. It's available on video on demand on multiple sites like Fandango Now, Google Play, and DirecTV On. A White, White Day is an Icelandic drama written and directed by Linur Pálmason. Amy?
This was the biggest surprise for me this week. I really love this film. The one-sentence plot synopsis here didn't have me salivating to watch it. It's about a widower. He's a policeman in a very small Icelandic town. And in the opening scene, his wife dies. She plunges off a road, and he becomes obsessed with the idea that she was having an affair before she died. And he, you know, goes a little bit crazy and obsessive as his way of dealing with his grief. And I was like, okay, I know this movie. The lead, when you see him, he has this really ultra-Viking Liam Neeson vibe. And yet the film itself, you know, its style, its tone, everything about it, it's made by this young director who has, you know, real vision, and this great team, this editor and the cinematographer working with him, that make this film so riveting and quietly funny from scene to scene. It has a real sense of control. You know, it opens with this long, long, long tracking shot following this car on this twisty, foggy, white rural road. And then just boom, you see the car kind of plummet off the side of the cliff. And there kept being times I wanted to just stop this movie and say, how did they do that shot? Like, what is happening in here? You know, it's such a talent behind the lens that you really become drawn into this film. And there's a young girl in here who plays the man's granddaughter named Selka, and she's just fabulous. I think she has a really lovely energy. She's the only person in the film he seems to really like. And their personality, the film's like really fully alive sense of place. I'm absolutely obsessed with this film, and I hope people follow it and check it out.
A White, White Day from Iceland, Lael.
I can't echo Amy's obsession, but I will agree that there is something really interesting to this film, and that the filmmaker has a distinct talent. This was Iceland's official Oscar submission for the international film category. And it's true. That opening shot is absolutely remarkable. I mean, everything from the soundtrack, which is kind of this kind of contemporary violins and things like that, to the pacing. And then you see this car careen off this cliff, and you're not even sure what you've seen, and you don't even know what kind of genre you're in, but you think this is a thriller. But really, this movie is more of a drama. And yes, there is a mystery. He's trying to unravel. Was his wife having an affair? If so, with whom? But what to me stuck were two things. One, the way that the director kind of chooses to piece together a story through certain stark images. Like he doesn't actually show you the accident, but you see far much later just the aftermath of the accident in just little images, a rock, a shoe, a piece of the car, these isolated little shots that are cut in together. That sticks in my mind. It was a really interesting way to explain that. And then also the relationship between the grandfather and his granddaughter felt absolutely 100% real. And that little girl was just absolutely so mature as an actress, just really remarkable. And there's the dynamic feels just incredibly authentic. So I like that. Movie. It's very cold sometimes, very stark, but it's certainly got something.
A White, White Day from Iceland, written and directed by Linur Pálmason. The film is unrated, and you can see it through the Frida's virtual cinema, the Frida's Santa Ana's own nonprofit theater. So when you watch the film, you're also supporting the Frida's efforts with independent and international cinema. A White, White Day. Away, animated adventure, written and directed by Geints Zilbalotis, and the animated feature. Charles has seen Away. What'd you think?
Well, at the risk of risking my zealously defended and hard-won curmudgeon title, I really like this movie. It was one of my favorite films last year because it's the antithesis of the big American studio films – like Trolls on Tour. It was done by a single Latvian artist, almost entirely single-handedly. It is minimal. It has no dialogue. It is quiet. It's meditative. It's slow. And it's about a young boy who crashes in a mysterious landscape and travels across it, trying to find safety from a giant that's pursuing him. Again, completely unlike anything we turn out in this country. The only thing I think you could compare it to might be some of Bill Plimpton's films in America. But intriguing, if you are willing to, you know, join with that pace and that minimalism. Again, I really like it.
All right, the film from Latvia, away from a writer-director, Gints Zibelodis. The film's unrated, and you can see the animated feature on Lemley's Virtual Cinema. The film starting there in just a couple of days. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. We have many more reviews from our critics coming right up. Wonderful to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Every Friday and Saturday, we bring you our critics' picks for the best in at-home watching, including brand new movies. One of them this week that's on Amazon Prime Video, Sella and the Spades. The film is rated R, and it's written and directed by Tyresha Poe. Amy, what do you think of Sella and the Spades?
Yeah, I saw Sella and the Spades for the first time when it premiered at Sundance a year and a half ago, and I'm glad to get a chance to see it again. It was a debut from Tyresha Poe that caught my attention, that she feels like a director to watch. And the story here is, it's about a prep school, but it's one of these kind of like heightened prep schools. You can imagine it in the same universe as Heathers or something like Paradise Hills, if people saw that film a few months ago. And in this prep school, it's divided into five factions. And we're mostly following the story of Sella. She's the senior spirit captain, and she rules a group called the Spades, who are like the drug and alcohol dealers of this prep school. You know, it's very kind of in that like 80s rules of the game. Everybody's on cocaine most of the time kind of deal. And she's trying to do a couple things. Like, one, she's trying to raise up a younger girl to take over the Spades when she graduates. Two, she's trying to keep like her second in command, who's played by Jerome of Moonlight, an actor I really love, a young actor I really think is interesting. He just won the Emmy for When They See Us. She's trying to make sure he does a good job as her second in command, especially when he starts to get a girlfriend. And then the third thing is she's trying to fight off her biggest rivals, who tend to be the drama geeks, who are trying to fight her for control of the school. And the film just starts off really incredibly strong. You know, it's very cold, it's very stylish. And the actress herself who's playing Sella, you know, Lovie Simone, she has this really commanding sense of presence, you know. And you get the sense this is very much, to Tyresha Poe, like a story about, you know, female power. You know, she comes onto the screen kind of like, she almost feels like an ancient Greek warrior maiden or something. And the movie itself can be a little bit light on story. And I think a lot of the hold that it has on you does fade out as it goes from kind of this very stern, darkly funny comedy to something more dramatic and emotional, that it doesn't quite bridge that gap when it tries to shift tones. But I'm very interested in Tyresha Poe as a director, and I'm very interested to see what she and also Lovie Simone are going to do next.
We're talking about Sella and the Spades. Lael, what'd you think?
I agree with Amy. I thought that the director really has interesting talent, and she's trying to do something interesting, take that whole the group of teenage high school movies, Heathers, Election, Mean Girls, all that, and sort of flip it a little bit. And there are some moments that really stood out for me. There's a direct address moment where Sella is talking about body shaming, and the way that's handled is just kind of extraordinary. I thought that was, you know, both powerful and powerfully presented. I thought that the tonal inconsistencies in the movie were a bit of a problem. Like, it starts off kind of strong, and then it sort of drifts and wobbles in the middle a little bit, and then it has kind of a strong finish that sort of sticks the landing, if you will. But in the middle, it didn't. It just didn't carry me, and I sort of lost interest a little bit. But I would like to see where Tyresha Poe can go with it, and she's certainly got some talent and is someone to watch for.
Sella and the Spades is rated R. It's streaming on Amazon Prime Video. The documentary The Booksellers takes us into the rare book world of New York City. Lael, what'd you think of the doc?
Okay, I love this movie so much. And, you know, I should just say that as film critics, we have a particular regard for our old films and for the works on which they're based. And so we might be the kind of people who would be inclined to appreciate a movie about independent booksellers and rare books. This movie is funny, charming. It interviews so many great luminaries of the independent bookselling world, including daughters of the founder of the Argosy bookstore. It also, you know, it looks at why people collect ephemera, why someone might decide to buy a 12 volume edition of Balzac for $30,000. You know, it's weird. It's funny. It's delightful. It reminds me a little bit of that documentary from a decade or so ago called King of Kong about people that were obsessed with video games. To me, this restored my faith, not just in books. My faith in books has always been there, but in people that love books. And it also makes the really kind of interesting argument, which is a counter argument to what we're usually hearing, that millennials, it's saying, do love books and are actually reading books. It's more the 40 year olds that are into reading the e-books, which, you know, to booksellers is sort of the biggest curse that you can imagine. So, you know, cheers for books, and this is a terrific documentary. I highly recommend it.
D.W. Young is the director of The Booksellers. Charles, did you like it?
Well, in full disclosure, I have rather extensive knowledge of this area. Every time I visit New York, I end up with piles of books, just as whenever I go to Paris, I have to send home about 14 kilos of books. I'm afraid I'm not as high on it. I don't think it's very well structured, that it kind of drifts from one interview and one subject to another without any really overarching structure or beginning, middle, and end. Fran Lebowitz kind of steals the whole film with her very barbed comments that are lots and lots of fun. There are books that I saw in the film and in the backgrounds that I wanted, but I think it's weak as a film. I don't think it is as well structured and well organized as it could be.
The Booksellers, the documentary, you can see it on the Frida Virtual Cinema, Lemley's Virtual Cinema, and other video on demand platforms. It's unrated. Endings, Beginnings, a drama that stars Shailene Woodley, Jamie Dornan, and Sebastian Stan. Drake Doremus is the director and co-screenwriter. Lael.
This is a decent sort of coming-of-age, rite of passage movie. It's got some directorial promise, I thought. Shailene Woodley is suffering from a recent heartbreak, a breakup with her boyfriend that she has initiated, and decides initially to have a period of abstinence. Well, she sort of jettisons that rather quickly and then decides to date not one, but two men who happen to be best friends. So she's gone from one end of the spectrum to the other. That, of course, causes all sorts of complications. And from one guy, she has a great physical sex life, but the other guy gives her intellectual stimulation. So she's sort of caught in this dilemma. What should she do? And the way out of it, I didn't like the ending. I won't reveal what happens, but it felt a little too pat to me. I liked Shailene Woodley. I liked the actors as well. Sebastian Stan and Jamie Dornan were both quite good, but I felt it just got a little bit pat at the end.
Amy, what do you think of Endings, Beginnings?
Yeah, I mean, Drake Doremus is a young director who has a lot of emotional intelligence. You know, like his first film, Like Crazy, I think it won a pretty big prize at Sundance. That was the love triangle between like Anton Yelchin and Jennifer Lawrence and Felicity Jones. And he's a guy who I think really gets human emotions. But there's something in this film where the character that Shailene plays, you know, just the sort of average LA mess who's trying and failing to make better choices in her life. And she basically cannot help making self-destructive, messy choices. She's really not, I think, in the place to start making good choices yet. She's a character who feels really credible. Like, I feel like I know a lot of her. I feel like I definitely relate to parts of her. And also there's a bit of who cares, you know, that she's such a good actor, but something in this film didn't quite come to life for me as dead on as it could be in a lot of the first half, a lot of like the first two acts of it. You know, there's so much in here to recognize, but it's almost too ordinary. I think Drake has a really good idea for details. He has a really good eye for details. You know, there's a shot where she goes on a road trip and you just see her character, you know, notice an animal skeleton on the side of the road. And it sounds like a heightened kind of moment, but yet it was really lovely. His eye for the things that he catches and for the way that people deal with their emotions is absolutely dead on. I just didn't care too much about the story. It just felt a little bit too ordinary to me.
And that earlier Doremus film you liked so much was the Sundance Grand Jury Prize for U.S. Drama in 2011, Like Crazy. We're talking, though, about Drake Doremus's Endings, Beginnings. The film is unrated. You can see it on video on demand, including iTunes and Fandango now. The drama Sergio is directed by Greg Barker. Craig Borton wrote the screenplay. Wagner Moura and Ana de Armas star in the film. Amy, tell us about Sergio.
Yeah, this is the story of the UN Sergio Vieira de Mello, who was trapped in the bombing in 2003 in Iraq and died during that attack. He was the High Commissioner for Human Rights for the United Nations. He was a guy who, you know, went to East Timor and then agreed to go to Iraq when we were trying to figure out if there was any sort of way to peacefully reestablish democracy in that country in Iraq, and then, you know, realizing that other people had different agendas. As kind of a first sort of opening thing to know about this film, you know, the director himself who made it, he's usually a documentary filmmaker, and he did a documentary on Sergio of the same name, and now he's telling the story as fiction. And he's mainly just talking about Sergio, it feels like, as a man. You know, what really seems to interest him is Sergio had a girlfriend at the time that he died. She was an Argentinian economist, James Carolina. She's played by Ana de Armas, who's really in here mostly just to look like this living dream, you know, this sense of potential in life that Sergio could have had. And you sense, you know, the idea of a man of principles who's capable of making mistakes, a man who's optimistic when the world doesn't quite deserve to be. He seems to really love Sergio, and as a person who had forgotten his story, honestly, you know, in the years since 2003, it was good to be reminded of this man and of the good men trying to make the world a better place. The film itself, you know, it's kind of emotionally pretty straightforward, but you do sense how well the director knows, honestly, not just Sergio. He's gone on to make documentaries about Iraq, documentaries about diplomacy. This kind of character and this kind of people, the people out there trying to do good in the world, really is the director's fixation. And while I thought the film itself was lovely, but not anything I was absolutely roused and excited about, I could definitely recommend it. And I'm glad to at least be reminded of Sergio himself.
The film Sergio, the drama's rated R. It's streaming on Netflix. Greg Barker directed. Craig Borton wrote it, starring Wagner Moura and Ana de Armas. We also want to remember Brian Dennehy, the burly actor, character actor, who not only was acclaimed for his stage performances on Broadway, he won 2 Tony Awards, but also was nominated for 6 Emmys for his work in television and had a number of important character roles in feature films as well. He was the level-headed leader of aliens in Cocoon, as well as the sequel. He was the sheriff who jailed Rambo in First Blood, serial killer in To Catch a Killer, the corrupt sheriff gunned down by Kevin Kline in Silverado. Let's take a moment to remember him. Lael, your memories of Dennehy.
Wow. Well, I remember, you know, he was an actor, obviously, of some physical heft, as you said, but I also remember that he brought a certain kind of gravitas to pretty much whatever he did, or at least some, you know, when you saw Dennehy, you knew, like, there was the quality there. I remember seeing him playing Clarence Darrow in a film called Alleged, based on the Scopes Monkey Trial. I thought he was excellent in that. And I think I also, he was so good as Willie Loman in Death of a Salesman, which was, I think he played on stage, and then it was adapted to a TV version. He was just terrific in that. There was a poignancy to him, an everyman quality, but also, you know, he could play the serious guy as well. So he just was such a terrific actor.
It's funny because he started in television, then feature films, and it was kind of later that he became such an icon for his live stage work, particularly, you know, with the masters, O'Neill, Miller, Chekhov, and Shakespearean productions. He died, by the way, at the age of 81 of natural causes in New Haven, Connecticut. Amy, your memories of Brian Dennehy?
Well, I was definitely a person who watched Cocoon nonstop on VHS tape when I was a kid. But as I grew up, I mean, Brian Dennehy, he also was such a really wonderful part of Romeo and Juliet, the Baz Luhrmann film. And he had this way, you know, as Layla is saying, of not just walking onto screen and carrying with him what you feel like is really the weight and intelligence and life experience of a real person. Like, his characters always felt so grounded. He was able to, you know, make fun of himself a little bit when the time came for it. I mean, I don't know if the name Tommy Boy has been said on the show decades, but he was in Tommy Boy and he was fantastic in it. And I'm sure Charles can also speak to the work that he did in animation. You know, he was a voice in Ratatouille, for example.
Yeah, Charles, quick thoughts about Brian Dennehy.
Well, fairly minimal, but Ratatouille is one of the best films Pixar ever made, and he was certainly part of that ensemble that you know, Brad could get a performance out of him, I suspect, rather easily.
All right. So Brian Dennehy passed away Wednesday, New Haven, Connecticut, at the age of 81 of natural causes. And we also share that cinematographer Alan Davio, and I hope I'm pronouncing his name correctly, who shot three Steven Spielberg films, including E.T. the Extraterrestrial, he's died at the age of 77 earlier this week. He died on Tuesday. He was a five-time Oscar nominee. He also was the cinematographer for Empire of the Sun, Bugsy, The Color Purple, Avalon, and Defending Your Life. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPECC. You know, the TCM Classic Film Festival in Hollywood was supposed to be getting underway at the Chinese Theater in Hollywood this weekend. Instead, they're bringing it to your living room. We'll get all the details coming right up. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle. One of the most eagerly anticipated film events each year in Southern California is the Turner Classic Movies Classic Film Festival. But this year, of course, TCM is not able to hold its typical film festival in the heart of Hollywood. But instead, it's bringing the festival to all of its viewers on TCM. Joining us to talk about the festival, which began Thursday evening, is Turner Classic Movies host Ben Mankiewicz, as well as his fellow host Dave Karger, who's also a special correspondent for IMDb, the Internet Movie Database. Ben and Dave, great to have you both with us on Film Week today. Ben, let me start with you about the idea of bringing the film festival into viewers' living rooms. How did that originate?
Well, it saddened all of us to have to cancel the festival. You know, we were experiencing what millions of people have experienced across the country, sort of the cessation of important social, meaningful events, right? And we worked very hard to plan for this festival. It started in 2010 as a way to reach out and connect with our fans, who are unlike the fans of any other channel on television. There's just no question that that's true. There's a loyalty to us rather than necessarily the movies. So we sort of, when we canceled that, I had to write the on-air note and then broadcast it that we were canceling the festival, and I got very emotional, and I think that reflected what the executives felt, everybody who works at this channel. So immediately, the Charlie Tavish, our head of programming, Paul Jagnon, our general manager, Genevieve McGillicuddy, who runs the festival, got their heads together and thought, how can we do something? Because we recognize that while we're look, there are doctors and nurses and scientists and researchers and postal workers and grocery store workers who are really out there risking themselves so that we can maintain some semblance of life. We're not like them. But these movies do matter to our audience, and we should do something to connect with them, to foster the sense of community that we have. And they came up with this idea, which was clearly, as I've been working on it, as Dave has for the last 10 days, it's been a it's a great idea, and the response has been wonderful.
Well, and Dave, one of the aspects of this aren't just a great series of classic films, which we'll talk about, but some of the real interview highlights of previous years. Now, Thursday night you showed, so it's too late for people to catch. We're listening to this broadcast, but Luis Rainer, live from the 2011 festival. I think I've seen that interview two or three times. It's just, she's 100 years old. And it's just remarkable, her energy, her sense of history of Hollywood, and particularly women in cinema. And it's great you can pull out some of these interview gems from the vaults.
Well, and that's the pleasure for all of us who work at TCM, is to encounter these people. Eva Marie Saint usually comes by the festival and is always a pleasure. I am definitely going to be watching Ben's interview with Faye Dunaway, which took place a couple of years ago, and that's airing right before we show Network. She is so fascinating, so I can't wait to see that.
Yeah.
Never seen that. But that's the pleasure of it for us, is to meet all of these people, Juliette Mills and James Ivory and Piper Laurie was set to come this year. But as you said, that is the nice thing, is that there is this backlog, treasure trove of interviews that Robert Osborne has done, that Ben has done, that are going to air as part of this stay-at-home festival.
Well, you mentioned Network and the Faye Dunaway interview Ben did with her that's going to precede it. I think that's coming up on Saturday night, if I'm not mistaken, 8:45 Eastern Time, 5:45 Pacific. But let's go back and listen to a clip from Network, one of my favorite films, the great Patty Chayefsky screenplay, a parody of network television, which proved rather prescient. Faye Dunaway, William Holden, Peter Finch, who won the Oscar for his performance, who delivers one of the most quoted lines in cinema history.
I don't want you to protest. I don't want you to ride. I don't want you to write to your congressman, because I wouldn't know what to tell you to write. I don't know what to do about the depression and the inflation and the Russians and the crime in the street. All I know is that first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. Damn it! My life has value! So I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
Ben, interviewing Faye Dunaway about that and other classic films in which she starred, that must have been a great experience.
Oh, it's been the, you know, I mean, there's so many highlights of working at TCM, but that's definitely in the top tier. And as you say, Network for out here in Southern California, 5:45 Saturday night. And then the interview with Faye will precede it at 4:45. You know, the interview was about 2 hours, and then we turned it into an hour-long television special. That's what we'll have. The Robert's interview with Eva Marie Saint, who Dave mentioned, is also on the schedule. I have another interview with Norman Lloyd. Now, you mentioned Louise Reiner, and who was 100 when she did the interview. Norman is currently 105 years old and alive and well in Brentwood, California, where he lives. And he's become a great friend of mine, and so is Eva Marie. And that has been just a delight. You prepare for these interviews, you work hard, and then you connect with these people. It's incredibly meaningful. I mean, I recognize the privilege that this job has given me to be able to call Norman Lloyd and check on him and make sure he's doing okay.
Wow.
And just real quick, I want to mention that these are our people. So when a guy like Norman Lloyd, who was 101, I think, when we did this, maybe 100, when he comes out on stage. Now, Norman Lloyd was in a Saboteur. He's the wonderful actor who falls off the Statue of Liberty toward the end of Saboteur. Then became a director and a producer on television for Hitchcock. And he's a wonderful actor, St. Elsewhere, many people know him from. When Norman comes out on stage, but he's a character actor, and when he comes out on stage at a TCM festival, you get, and they're, you know, whatever the theater size is, there is this cacophonous roar as if it's Judy Garland.
I knew what you were going to say, because TCM, those of us that love TCM, we know who he is, and we would applaud like that.
So it's really, that's a great, great, great experience. And there are a couple other things that I just, because you mentioned Louise, and if you didn't catch it last night, you missed it. But I did a conversation that we've put on social media that you'll be able to find with Genevieve McGillicuddy, our festival director, who'll give you a behind the scenes of everything that went on that night trying to get Louise at 100 plus years old to first fly from London to Los Angeles and then get on and have a conversation with Robert Osborne and not have her hearing aids. It's a wonderful, wonderful story. And I had a wonderful conversation with Eva Marie Saint that we have put yesterday that we've also put up online.
Is there anyone more charming than Eva Marie Saint? I've also had the pleasure to have her on the show, and just a delightful person.
Yep.
Absolutely. We're talking with Ben Mankiewicz and Dave Karger. I'm sure you recognize their voices if you're a regular viewer of TCM, Turner Classic Movies. We're talking about the Classic Film Festival that TCM does in Hollywood every year. Become a hugely popular event. Thousands of people come out to the Chinese Theater and venues there at the Chinese for the TCM Festival, the Hollywood Roosevelt Hotel, and everything right there in the center of the movie town. But of course, because of COVID-19, now the festival has moved to TCM itself. And Ben, are the films also available on the TCM app as well?
Many of them are. As I'm sure people familiar with the business know, securing the rights to show the movie on air is different than securing the rights to stream a movie on the Watch TCM app, which is a fantastic app. And it frustrates people sometimes to think, oh, well, I missed a movie on the air. I'll just watch it on I'll just stream it on the app. But sometimes somebody else has the streaming rights to that movie, and we're not able to do that. But many of them will be on the Watch TCM app. And as you'll see, there's always, 100 wonderful movies on the app, many of which had aired earlier on TCM.
We'll talk about some of the other classics that are part of TCM Classic Film Festival Special Home Edition, kicked off Thursday night and runs through this Sunday on TCM Turner Classic Movies. We'll talk about other great films like Alfred Hitchcock's The Lady Vanishes from 1938 and the silent classic The Passion of Joan of Arc of 1928. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. So good to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. If you're a fan of classic film, you don't want to miss TCM's Classic Film Festival. Not actually on Hollywood Boulevard this year, but instead on TCM with a special home edition going through this Sunday. It includes some of the great interviews over the course of previous years at the Hollywood event, as well as classic films hosted by Ben Mankiewicz, who joins us, by Dave Karger, who's with us as well, and TCM's other terrific hosts. Let's talk about some of the other films that are going to be shown, including The Passion of Joan of Arc, a silent film. And you had this with live orchestra back in 2016. I don't know, Dave, can you tell us a bit about that?
Absolutely. The silent films, I'm a huge silent film fan. We actually have a new host, Jacqueline Stewart, who's our new host of Silent Sunday Nights as well, who's absolutely fabulous. But one of the highlights for me of the TCM Classic Film Festival is that most years they do have a silent film presented with live orchestra. Last year we showed A Woman of Affairs, and actually one of the musicians was the grandson of John Gilbert, the star of the movie. I love The Passion of Joan of Arc, the performance of Maria Falconetti, just it's all in her face, and it's some of the most mesmerizing acting I've ever seen. Some people consider it one of, the top 10 or so best screen performances, full stop. So that's one I'm looking forward to. I'm glad we're showing that. We showed Metropolis, Safety Last, another great silent film, Harold Lloyd, who actually I dressed up as for Halloween on the cruise this past fall, with the help of our fantastic TCM stylist, Holly Hattesty, and some black lipstick. But yeah, so I'm happy that those kind of films and some great pre-code movies are in there, along with some of what I would call the greatest hits of TCM, like North by Northwest and Casablanca and Deliverance and things like that. It's a really great lineup that Charlie Tabish, our head programmer, and his team put together along with the kind of live event interviews that are sprinkled in there, too.
The penultimate film as part of the on-air festival is late Sunday night, 10:45 Pacific, 1:45 a.m. for those getting the East Coast feed. I'm not familiar with this film that apparently was recently restored, Bartleby's The Magnificent from 1926. Dave, what can you tell us about that?
Just that it also has John Gilbert in it, who is this great actor who, you know, had a little bit of a trouble with the transition from silent to sound, although he was so handsome. And the director, King Vidor, obviously a very prolific director of the time, that's one that I'm going to set my DVR for because it's one I've never seen. So, and as I mentioned, I love the silent film. So that's the great thing about it, as I mentioned, that there's not all of the movies are ones that everyone has seen. There's some discoveries in there for even the hardcore fan as well.
Alfred Hitchcock's The Lady Vanishes, one of his early British films, 1938. And back in 2013, Norman Lloyd was in attendance for that, Ben?
Yeah, I mean, Norman has been a regular at the festival, and nobody knows Hitchcock like Norman. And not only did Hitchcock give Norman a role in Saboteur, which, by the way, Norman had moved back to New York and then landed that his first picture. But if he'd stayed in Los Angeles, he was part of the Mercury Theater crowd that came out to Los Angeles with Orson Welles. There's an excellent chance that Norman would have been in Citizen Kane if he'd stayed in L.A. So instead of working for Welles in L.A., he went back to New York and worked with Hitchcock. It was going to work out either way for Norman. Norman, you know, is a guy who in the middle of a conversation, first, his memory is amazing. And he'll be talking to you about a lunch he had with Bertolt Brecht and Charlie Chaplin in 1944. And then he'll get irritated because he can't remember the name of the restaurant. And you're like, Norman, the restaurant's been closed for 60 years. You're missing the point. Back to Chaplin and Bertolt Brecht.
Well, that's why he's so cognitively together as a centenarian. Clearly, he's exercising that memory constantly. Also, to be screened, Babyface from 1933. That's a pre-Hays Code film, isn't it, Ben?
Yeah, that's right. That's one of the best pre-code films. The production code had been around for about 4 years, but it didn't start flexing its muscle until 1934. So these movies, these sound movies like between 1930 and 1934, are far racier than most people expect from Hollywood studio films. You know, man and woman might actually sleep in the same bed, crazy stuff like that. Women were frequently far more empowered in these early movies than they were in the sort of domestic roles that they were so often reduced to in so many pictures for the next 50 years. Babyface with the great Barbara Stanwyck is one of those movies, a woman who literally sleeps her way to the top of a bank. But she is the driver of this. This is her decisions. She destroys essentially the men who she comes into contact with. These are her choices, her power. And it's a terrific, terrific movie where you can, by the way, catch one of her conquests is a young John Wayne.
That's right. I'd forgotten about that. It's such a great performance Stanwyck gives in Babyface. That's at 9:15 on Sunday night, the final night of the special home edition of the TCM Classic Film Festival 2020 for East Coast feed. That's 12:15 a.m., appropriately late for Babyface. It's funny, I caught Norman Lloyd with a performance, and I've forgotten. It was a noir film, pre-code, where... And I can't remember if it was Lloyd's character, but someone actually flipped someone off in the film. I thought definitely pre-Hays Code to see that.
Totally. If that happened in a movie.
Yeah. It was on TCM, actually. That's so funny. We're talking with Ben Mankiewicz, who's, of course, host Turner Classic Movies, and Dave Karger, fellow host Turner Classic Movies, and special correspondent for IMDb, the Internet Movie Database. We're talking earlier about Orson Welles, Mercury Theater, and Magnificent Amberson sometimes gets a bit overlooked in the shadow of Citizen Kane, but Ben, important, of course, to talk about Amberson's just a gem of a film.
Yeah, it's quite good. It holds up really well, and of course, we've lost Welles's cut of it, which was longer. When he was out of the country, it was chopped up by the studio. But that said, it's still quite good. And joining us Saturday night for both Casablanca, I think at 8 o'clock Eastern, so 5 out here, and then followed by Amberson's, is Peter Bogdanovich, the wonderful director, who, by the way, going back to King Vidor, once called me because to show you just how even deeply knowledgeable film fans discover something, he saw the King Vidor film The Crowd on TCM and called just to say that he hadn't seen it and he was blown away. So, but Peter will join us, and nobody can talk about Orson Welles quite like Peter Bogdanovich. Welles lived with Peter and Sybil Shepherd for 3 years, off and on for 3 years, during which their friendship blossomed and then fell apart. And Peter also shares his thoughts on Casablanca, which are wonderfully funny. And our first ever TCM podcast is called The Plot Thickens. I'm still Peter Bogdanovich. That will be available April 28th, so, you know, in a week from Tuesday. And we'll have a clip from the podcast where Peter talks about Amberson's and watching Amberson's in the 1970s in a hotel with Orson Welles.
Oh, my God.
His reaction. It's an amazing, amazing story.
Oh, I've got to hear that. Ben Mankiewicz, Dave Karger, TCM. Thank you both for being with us and talking about the TCM Classic Film Festival. It's underway now. Thursday night's when it kicked off. It goes through late Sunday night. The special home edition, which takes the place of this year's in-person TCM Classic Film Festival in Hollywood. Hopefully it returns to Hollywood Boulevard in 2021. From all of us at Film Week, have a wonderful weekend. Thanks for joining us.